Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. From satellites to rocket parts, every day, thousands of miles are traveled by countless objects above us in our Earth's orbit. Sometimes these objects get a little too close for comfort, scaring scientists across the world. And if two objects collide, it could create a domino effect, filling our orbit with small pieces of space debris. How did all these objects enter our orbit, and what are we doing about them right now? How urgent is the issue? Lauren Kahn is a senior research analyst at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. She's the co-author of a recent analysis, Tracking Space Debris. Welcome to All Sides, Lauren.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
So why is space debris such a problem? I mean, I'm just thinking about how big the Earth is and how big space is. Is it a big problem?
Absolutely. Well, if you think about all the time that, you know, humans have been involved in spaceflight and activities in space, we get a lot of our, you know, we rely on a lot of communications, a lot of our day-to-day daily operations from capabilities that are in space. And like any other, you know, issue of littering or, you know, getting areas messy, once you put items up in space, unlike when you can just easily pick them up off the ground and Earth, it's really, really hard to get them out in space. And so that can cause problems for once you have other capabilities up there, and that can cause things at risk and things like the case of that, which just happened a couple weeks ago with the Chinese astronauts that ended up getting their return mission to Earth delayed because of an impact due to a piece of debris.
My knowledge of space debris comes from movies where you have like people in it's a movie in space and they try to like maneuver around space debris and it's all over the place and it causes all kinds of problems. I mean, is that what we're talking about? Is that like we could just like run right into it, and because there's so much of it and it's going to cause huge problems for missions?
Yeah, I think if you think about it this way, like over the past seven decades of human space activity, we've put thousands of satellites, scientific instruments, crewed spacecraft, and other payloads, which we've launched into orbits. And so alongside these missions, you have little bits and pieces that break off or satellites that end up going defunct. And these can cause, you know, while they traditionally and usually tend to fall out of orbit without any intervention by humans, they really, again, can stay up there and cause damage to other pieces up there. If you think about it, you know, things even 10 centimeters in size, they might not seem dangerous, mm-hmm. but at orbital velocities where they're traveling in space, its impact is basically equivalent if you have like 7 kilograms of TNT or a 550-pound object traveling at 60 miles per hour on Earth. And so according to NASA, orbital debris is really the number one space threat to spacecraft, satellites, and astronauts. So yes, it can, you know, cause really expensive maneuvers. You might have to go around it. It can cause issues like it happened last week where it actually impacts a spacecraft and prevents astronauts from going out. You know, back in 2023, for example, a spacewalk couldn't happen because astronauts would be at risk because there was debris floating around in the area. And in other cases, you know, it's collided with other satellites and, you know, caused more debris and rendered them inoperable, right? So if it takes, say, a communication satellite offline, you'll have to wait to launch another one, or you rely on another capability in order to get those services back online.
So who is responsible for the space debris? Like who made the most of it, and whose problem is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you think when you think about space, you think of this global commons. It's treated this way. You know, it's the province of all mankind, is the 1967 space treaty puts it. But in practice, reaching space is really, really technical and really, really challenging. And the rules governing it aren't very strong and enforceable. And so you actually only have like three countries that are really engaged in space research, space engagement in like a really meaningful way. Right. Other states and operators are really also engaging in space, rely on others. But really those who are leading the charge are, you know, China, Russia, and the former Soviet Union, and the United States. And they all together, just those three countries, contribute about 95% of all space debris currently in orbit.
Okay. So if it's China, Russia, and the United States' fault, can we work together to clean it up? You mentioned that it's hard to clean up. So tell me about the cleanup process. Can't you just like put a big net out and grab it all?
You're not totally wrong. You're not totally wrong. Those are the kind of experimental technologies that folks are sort of engaging in and exploring right now. There are nets, you know, there are private commercial actors that you see with the increasing commercialization of space, that there are, you know, robotic arms, harpoons, tethers, you know, drag enhancing device that, you know, companies are starting to try to address this problem to avoid the sort of issues that space debris cause. And you have a lot of other international institutions creating, you know, zero debris commitments. They're thinking about how to reduce their debris. But the problem with these technologies is that they're very experimental and not scalable. And so you really don't have anything reliable at a cost-effective way to remove pieces once they're up there. So the best, you know, proactive kind of approach is prevention of future debris. And so there is hope, again, given, you know, there are only three countries that could come together. There's been some, you know, progressive regulation on these kinds of things on a unilateral level. You know, the United States FAA, you know, after some debris objects were caused by some left rocket stages up in space, started breaking up in 2018, 2019. The FAA put out a new rule about how to actually, you know, prevent debris and made it the responsibility of certain companies, et cetera, and those launching things into space to remove it. You know, you have to have a controlled reentry. You might have to move the upper stage to a less congested part of space. You might have to, you know, retrieve the upper stage within 5 years, you know, those kinds of efforts. But also, you know, when you have other sources of debris, things like anti-satellite weapons tests also create a large amount of debris. And actually one in 2007 that the Chinese launched was the single largest debris creating event of all time. And so while, you know, there are ways to prevent and create regulations to prevent the most debris creating activity, so to speak. And so the United States, for example, is the first country to commit to a moratorium on prevention of, like, you know, the of the most debris creating anti-satellite weapons test back in a couple years ago. And so there are indications that this is something that states can do moving forward.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about space debris with Lauren Kahn, a senior research analyst at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Once the debris is up there and orbiting around, does it tend to stay there or does it fall to Earth?
It tends to stay there. Again, it depends on where it ends up. A lot of the debris, you know, eventually will caused by drag will be pulled down to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere. But it can stay up there for an average of 15, 20, you know, X number of years. We're seeing pieces of debris that were launched again back in the, you know, the dawn of the space age in the 1950s that are still there. So it really all depends. It's easier if it's in low Earth orbit, they're more likely to fall to Earth. But if it gets slung into the higher orbits, you know, it's a little bit harder to get to.
So we want it to fall to Earth because then it'll burn up. Is that like a good thing?
Yes, it burns up in the atmosphere usually. They don't usually fall all the way to the Earth and wreck havoc. Yeah.
Okay. So it would be a good thing if it burned up, I guess.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
would you consider this? Is this an urgent problem, tackling space debris, or is it something like how much urgency do we need to place on this?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, it's space is by definition like a far-flung place, right? It seems like this is not an issue that we need to deal with today. But with the increasing commercialization of space, you know, I really start to worry about this issue. You mentioned, you know, at the top about this cascading effects of worries about debris running into other debris and causing more and more. That's known as the Kessler syndrome, which was first proposed by NASA scientists in the late 1970s. And it came out of acknowledgement about this debris issue, right, where you end up with this unusable orbit, essentially, because of, you know, one small piece of debris hits a bigger piece and it's just really unlucky, right? And so I think that, you know, we're seeing that there are about, you know, currently today about 13,000 pieces of debris greater than 10 centimeters in space as of this past April. And I'm starting to get a little worried when I think about all the technologies of my day-to-day life that rely on access to space, think about, you know, global timing signals that underpin our financial systems, weather forecasts, GPS, and really any location-based services, long-distance communications. And then you think about even how militaries rely not just on space-based capabilities and awareness, but things to enable, say, GPS guidance for precision guided munitions or smart bombs or intelligence and reconnaissance or secure communications. I think it really becomes clear that it's not just a matter of convenience, but ensuring that, I have my creature comforts, but also national security as well. And it's pretty urgent, this issue about, the astronauts is just a matter of time, and I think it's only going to increase if we don't really do anything proactively to mitigate our debris creation in space.
So it is possible that a piece of space debris could hit a very important satellite and basically like knock off everyone's cell phones, right? Yep.
Yeah,
Oh, great.
there's usually some redundancy. There are additional levels to ensure that, if one satellite goes down, not everything goes down. But if you render the whole area inoperable and make it really, really expensive to operate in space, we're going to have to think of alternatives.
Do the private space missions that we're seeing more and more of, do they create space debris?
Yeah, everything creates space debris. You're seeing a lot of a big, advantage. You're seeing reusable rockets. It's like the biggest one, not only in terms of cost and effectiveness, but not as many pieces end up, up in space. And you're seeing, this more proactive understanding again with FAA regulations, but you can't avoid it to a certain degree. And so there it really has to be a collaboration between governments and, these private sector companies to ensure that they're behaving in space responsibly.
So do we need companies like SpaceX to create some sort of like netting system and grab some space debris every time they come back down?
That would be good. On the same time, though, it gets really, really tricky with the area because if you think about it, each of these capabilities is really good, right? When you're removing space debris, but they also makes them inherently dual use. If you can use a net, say, for example, or one of these removal technologies to take a satellite out of space, it also could kind of be a weapon to take someone else's capability out of space for malicious
Ooh.
reasons. So there's a little bit of a,
Oh
you know,
dear. Okay. I meant it
you have to
so
balance.
I meant it so innocently, but I
Yeah,
didn't think of that. Okay.
exactly.
So like
And so there are.
we could go up and take a Russian satellite and be like and grab it and be like, this is mine now.
Yeah, or like if it was space debris, right? We wouldn't do that. And it's very easy to see what's going on in space, which is really, really great. We're able to track all of these pieces. NASA is able to track all these pieces. We could see when debris hit, something happened and hit the space shuttle, for example. But yeah, it does there it's not inherently, without risk and all net positive. It requires some considerations and, risk calculus as well.
When I think of, I mean, my knowledge of the Apollo missions is basically from the movie Apollo 13. But when I think about watching the rockets launch in the Apollo missions, the point was that they broke off into all kinds of little pieces. Are there still pieces from the Apollo missions floating around up there?
I didn't see any particularly that I noticed that were from those missions. There are pieces from really, really early space missions that NASA did. Yeah, I would say that there are, especially the Delta One rockets, which were used for the United States for like really, really popular throughout the 60s and 70s to get things into space. And so there are debris, yeah, from really the early days.
Is the United States, China, or Russia, are we all equally doing this, or is Russia or China messier than we are?
Yeah, it's a tough question because if you look at like the top, all of the 73% roughly about all the debris in orbit can categorize from like roughly just 20 sources. So like 20 groups of things like just from Delta stage rockets or just from this one satellite. Right now, based on our analysis, China is the number one contributor to space debris. And this is largely, again, because of that anti-satellite weapons test that I mentioned back in 2007, which is pretty dramatic. You think about the whole history of human engagement in space and to have one instance create still the lasting percentage of all debris. I think it's almost like 19% of all track debris still in orbit. And so when you think about that, again, it makes that Kessler effect really real. It's just like one, two, three bad kind of collisions or fragmentation events away from a pretty cluttered orbit.
Okay, so the best thing we can do right now, though, is prevention. So that's what basically, do all three countries need to agree to if whenever we're going up there, whatever we're doing, we need to just minimize the debris.
Absolutely. I think, and it's a tough, tense geopolitical time, but I think this is in everyone's best interest. As I mentioned, I think about all the things that states rely upon on their day-to-day basis. Everyone relies upon on their day-to-day basis, not just those three states, about space-based capabilities. And so I think there's a pretty strong incentive to start to think about this issue in a really kind of meaningful way.
Do you think we could see some sort of space treaty being signed by the three countries?
Historically, there have been, space treaties. Space is a place that has a pretty robust prior sort of history about negotiations and like who free and fair access, including the 1967 treaty, which is like the kind of pinnacle, which is basically like everyone deserves free and fair access to space, and space debris inhibits that. So even just based on the treaties that are already kind of in existence, there is a strong like push and normative angle to work together on these issues. I think it really comes down to, are there rooms for collaboration on some of these technologies, on some of these like best practices, on again kind of devices that are less likely to create debris in space, so to speak.
We've been talking about space debris and what to do about it with Lauren Kahn, Senior Research Analyst at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Lauren, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about efforts to make the internet and social media safer for young people. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Gen Z and Gen Alpha have the reputation for having the most access to information in human history, thanks to the internet and social media. However, both are chock full of security threats to minors, from misinformation to privacy violations, and this is making many parents wary of their children's access to technology. It's for those reasons that Design It For Us, a youth coalition set on making the internet and social media safer for kids, was founded. They have been working hard to advance policy changes that protect the privacy of children online and now number in the hundreds worldwide. Joining us to discuss Design It For Us is co-founder and co-chair Zaman Qureshi. He is an advocate, a policy expert, a strategist focused on tech accountability, online safety, and privacy. Welcome to All Sides, Zaman.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the safety of children on the internet has been a hot topic for decades, since basically the internet started. How can both kids and parents help everyone stay safe online in their everyday lives? What is your number one tip, I would say?
Yeah, so we believe that social media companies in many ways have gotten away with addicting and exploiting our generation's agency and attention. And I think in lieu of companies actually being regulated from the kinds of harms that you were talking about, we have to sort of fend for ourselves out here. I think there's a number of ways in which there are current products out there, such as screen limiting or going into your settings and adjusting certain privacy features to prevent the endless collection of data online. But in reality, as consumers, we have very little choice when it comes to both the products that we use and the kinds of safety protections that are in place.
From what I've heard, all the directors for your group, Design It For Us, are between the ages of 18 and 26. Why do you think it's important for young people to lead this charge in this trying to change what's happening with the internet and social media?
Yeah, so we're an organization of young people working to hold these companies accountable, working to uphold our generation's agency in online spaces. And we believe deeply in this idea of safety by design and privacy by default as the mechanisms to hold these companies accountable. Now, I think young people need to be at the core of designing and thinking about what are the right solutions to hold social media companies accountable, because we're the primary users. And oftentimes I find in our policy conversations, not enough policymakers are thinking, talking to, or consulting with young people.
So you have met with some pretty powerful people when it comes to talking about this. You've met with members of Congress. Have you Have they been receptive to you? Like, when you have these meetings, do you feel like the political leaders, you've even met with top executives of some social media companies, are they listening to you?
I think that there is a real political urgency to try and address this issue. Now, while there is the urgency to try and address this issue, there is still the massive amounts of money that companies are pouring in on a day-to-day basis to prevent regulation from taking effect. And that happens both at the state and the federal level. At the federal level, last year, we tried to pass sweeping kids online safety legislation. And ultimately, that got blocked because Meta decided to put an AI data center in Louisiana, which is the home of the Speaker of the House. These kinds of deals or trade-offs that happen circumvent the political will of constituents, of people who actually get affected by a lot of this. And so in lieu of that, we've been urging states to take up a lot of the work that the federal government has failed to do, because I think there's more political will at the local level. And frankly, I think lawmakers are really frustrated that these companies have continued to get away with addicting and exploiting our generation. We've worked on this bill for a number of years called the Age Appropriate Design Code in states such as Maryland, Vermont, Nebraska, Minnesota. And we started this off by passing it in California. Now, the tech industry has sued to block that law from coming into effect in a number of places. But states can lead the way in protecting young people online by enacting this kind of law. And, you know, I would urge any lawmaker who has power or influence in the state of Ohio to consider to do the same thing.
So you're saying that Design It For Us is now going kind of state by state instead of trying to do it at the federal level. Do you feel like that's going to work? Is that harder going state by state, or are you finding it to be easier?
I think we need both, and we still strongly believe in the federal government has a responsibility to protect our generation online. But what we hope is that by enacting the kinds of protections that we want to see, age-appropriate design regulates companies operating in the state by protecting young people online, by regulating social media's design features. Companies have to assess whether their products induce certain kinds of harm. There's certain privacy features that are set to default. So it restores a set of agency for young people. It also gives parents peace of mind as well, because if you know that the product that your child is accessing is at least a little bit safer, it takes some of the burden off of you to have to figure out whether, you know, a product that your kid is using is safe or not. And so I think in lieu of the government, the federal government taking this kind of action, states can put real pressure on the federal government by enacting the same kinds of protections at the state level across the country. And we've seen this too. Companies will show up to Congress and say, you know, it's gotten too much for us to deal with all of these competing state regulations. Please regulate us in a blanket way. Now, they go ahead and then block that regulation from coming into effect or ever getting passed. But that is part of the goal here.
Talk to me about how you advocate or talk to parents, because you're talking about talking at the federal level to state lawmakers. But you also said at the beginning that you parents need to understand how to use the controls properly. I can speak as a parent myself. I had to watch a YouTube tutorial video to figure out how to put the parental safety the way I wanted it. Like, I knew what I wanted to do and I followed the directions and I got it figured out. But it was a lot of steps, I'm going to say, to make my daughter's phone safe the way I wanted it.
Yeah, I talk to parents a lot about this issue, and you are not alone. Parents around the country struggle with this issue. It is deliberately meant to be difficult, and that is by design. Ohio is currently suing Meta right now related to kids' harms. And one of the things that's been revealed in a lot of the litigation around Meta is that companies have built in more steps into your settings to try and prevent you from accessing the settings that are going to restrict their bottom line. So they make money off of ads. And if you make those ads less personalized, maybe you find them less interesting, that leads you to spending less time on that product. So they deliberately make it more difficult for you to actually try and find the tools that it says it builds in. One of the other things these companies could do is tell you when they've actually changed a setting or added a setting that would help you. We get these pop-ups from companies all the time. We know the second somebody likes one of our posts, we know the second somebody comments or reshares it. But how often do we get a notification from a company that says, "Hey, here's this setting that you should check out that's actually going to keep you safe or more private online." So when I talk to parents, I think one of the key things to understand, first of all, is that it's not you against your kid. You have to be working as a unit together because these companies rely on the kid or the parent being the victimized one in this situation when the attention is not being directed at the company. I think that there are a number of challenges to try and regulate our own social media usage, both as adults and young people in this digital age. So turning our attention towards the companies while also trying to build safety and privacy habits at home is what we have to do to kind of get to where we need to go right now.
I'm happy to hear I wasn't the only one struggling with the settings menu, though, because I felt like I was like, this has to be easier. But anyway, we made it through. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Juravich on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about children's internet safety with advocate and co-founder of Design It For Us, Zaman Qureshi. One of your advisors is Francis Hagen, from a former Facebook product manager from their now defunct Civic Integrity team. And she became well known as a Facebook whistleblower. She testified before Congress, and she basically said that Facebook and Instagram both know how to make it safer, but they won't do it because it negatively impacts profits. Do you agree with her? That's what Facebook and Instagram are doing. They know what they need to do. They just don't want to do it.
I absolutely do. And it's not just Frances Haugen, it's Arturo Bejar who came forward as a whistleblower. It is Jason Sadison and Casey Savage who came forward as whistleblowers earlier this year, and the six other whistleblowers who are named anonymously in a complaint of employees who are still working at the company and they're sounding the alarm about what's going on. So we've seen this track record over time. It's not just one person or one whistleblower at this point. And the attorneys general who are suing these companies, they're getting all of these documents from inside the company, which is showing that these companies know that if they turn certain features on or off, it can improve young people's time spent, their mental health, but it may cost some of their bottom line in doing so. For example, Meta kicked around this idea called Project Daisy to turn off like counts by default for young people. And they showed positive use case that if you turned off like counts by default, it made young people feel less like they were quantifying their self-worth by their posts with one another. But they didn't enable that by default. You can go in and turn them off if you want to, but the company could have done it for every person under the age of 18, and they chose not to. And this comes back to our theory of change around age-appropriate design. If we can mandate certain requirements for these companies to do the things that are going to protect us online, maybe we can actually thrive in these online spaces and not feel like we are sort of at the whims of these companies. And I know there's a lot of discussion right now about what are the right ways to do this, whether this is restricting access, whether there's age verification, whether we need to ban social media. At the end of the day, I would implore people who are thinking about this, especially at the state level, to think about how they can do this in a way that is going to tackle the core business model of the companies. Because A, that is what they are most afraid of, and B, that is actually what's going to restore agency for young people.
Her testimony as a Facebook whistleblower generated a tremendous amount of news coverage, calls for congressional action. But as you mentioned earlier, there hasn't been substantial change at the federal level. If someone from in the company is saying that this needs to change, like, how can we get the federal government to make the change?
I think it has to be grassroots power. And the way that we do that as an organization is to bring and uplift young people's stories to people in positions of power. That is how we've gotten as far as we did last year at the federal level. It was parents who have lost their kids to social media related harms and young people who've been affected by it telling their story to lawmakers over and over and over. And that is what big tech is not able to have a counter for. They can put millions and millions of dollars behind their lobbying campaigns, but at the end of the day, they can't discredit the experience of somebody who's grown up or used these products and has a story to tell. We always say that every young person has a lived experience on these products, whether they think it or not. And our lived experience is our expertise. Because we've grown up online, we are so familiar with how these products work. And so we should be empowered to share that story with people in positions of power to advocate for what we want to see. And so, if anyone's listening to this and interested in learning more about the work that we're doing, Design It For Us wants to uplift the voices of young people who are affected by social media, whether they think that that effect was a small part of their life or whether it's dominated a large part of their life.
Before this show started, I walked through the newsroom and I looked up at the TV and there was a headline on CNN that says Roblox to enact more safety controls. So I guess that's maybe a new thing. Can you talk a little bit about Roblox and what they need to do safety-wise and what that story, I mean, I only read the headline as I was walking through, what that might have been about?
Yeah, I haven't seen the new safety changes that Roblox announced today, but I do know the track record of the company. And I will say we cannot rely on the commitments that these companies make to us publicly. If we come back to Meta has routinely announced the same updates to its safety features, like over the course of 3 to 5 years. They'll roll out the same thing and package it up as something different. And we, as the consumer, are sort of have to take that at face value. Like, we need to be able to be discerning about what these companies are actually saying and whether what they're doing is positively affecting our mental health and our safety and well-being. And like, if it actually ends up being that the company has to take a profit hit as a result, then they should, be forced to reckon with the consequences of that. The other thing I'll say is that, Roblox over the years has, I think, attempted to try and work in good faith around these kinds of issues and or be shown as working in good faith. I would urge them as a company to put their money where their mouth is. And if they're serious about the set kind of safety protections that they announced today, they could also endorse legislation at the state and the federal level that holds their company accountable, whether that's age-appropriate design, whether that's comprehensive privacy or safety at the federal level. This is a company that initially was supportive of age-appropriate design codes. We'd like to see them do more about that in the coming months and years.
What can your group do for something like TikTok? You can't even get federal regulations for Meta, which is actually based here. I mean, how can you protect young people from companies that are from outside of the US?
It's a good question, and I think it's also a really interesting thing to think about globally, because for the countries who don't have these companies domiciled within their borders, they face a real challenge because they don't have the same legal protections or powers that we do in the United States. All that to say, we have a lot of responsibility as a country to get this right for the rest of the world. With all of these companies mostly being domiciled in California and Silicon Valley, the kinds of regulations that we enforce here have sweeping effects worldwide. And so I would urge our lawmakers to think about that as well, that what we are doing, what we can do to positively protect young people here, has ripple effects outside of the US. In regards to TikTok, some of the bills and laws that we've advocated for have forced companies who own or operate a product within a certain geographic region, whether or not they actually have, corporate headquarters in that place, they have to comply with the same rules as everyone else. I think that's how we get there. We cannot look at certain companies and say, you are exempt from these kinds of regulations versus another. There needs to be a blanket set of standards for the largest social media companies because they're often using the same kinds of addictive design features and products to keep people on the platform longer. And that's not to say that social media hasn't had tremendous benefits for connecting people. We know that, but we can improve and we can demand better a kind of social media that works for us.
Anecdotally, I feel like Europe has better or more regulation than the United States, doesn't it? Right?
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, right now it has its Digital Markets Act and its Digital Services Act, which it passed a couple years ago, which would rein in these companies. Currently, the administration and honestly EU officials as well have seen this, the DMA and the DSA, as some kind of trading chip in the broader trade war between the United States and the EU. I mean, we believe that the EU has a lot of power with the DSA and the DMA to regulate both competition and the digital services around the companies that operate within the EU. And they shouldn't be sidelining their laws, which their citizens demanded. I mean,
the DSA and the DMA, what is that?
So the Digital Services Act regulates companies, essentially their digital infrastructure. And the Digital Markets Act looks at companies as market participants in sort of a competition sense. So you think about Google, you think about Apple, Amazon, these companies who have been argued to have large monopolies globally, or at least in the jurisdictions in which they're regulated, they have the opportunity as the EU to bring certain cases or complaints against the companies for certain violations of the Digital Markets or Digital Services Act. I think those are levers that we need to be pulling on, because in lieu of the US regulating, we do need our counterparts abroad to be helping us out.
We've been talking about children's internet safety on the internet and social media with advocate and co-founder for Design It For Us, Zaman Qureshi. Zaman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up, one of the world's top brands for tech gear might not be able to offer their products in the US anymore. We'll find out why. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. DJI, one of the world's top brands for tech gear, might not be able to offer their products in the United States anymore. And as Apple develops its AI version of Siri, they are looking into Google's Gemini as an option. We're talking about these recent tech stories and more with the Director of Commerce Content for CNET, Russell Hawley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So the U.S. government, specifically it's the FCC, has deemed DJI based in China as a security risk. What is everyone so upset about with this company, DJI?
DJI is a company that's based in China and so is largely viewed as a security risk in very much the same way that, routers from TP-Link and chips from some of the companies over there are, you know, not products that you typically see here in the US. What DJI has done they've been, you know, kind of one of the biggest drone companies that sells here in the US. They are by far the most popular among photographers and things like that. But the way that their products enter the US is viewed by the current FCC as a loophole that they are currently voting to close.
Okay. So is it just the drone products or all products made by this company?
All products made by DJI. DJI primarily makes, you know, drones and their accessories, but they've also had quite a bit of success with things like, smart handhelds for your camera so that you have a stabilizer when you go to take video if you're, you know, at an event or something like that. They have a bunch of different products, but the thing that they are known for is these really nice camera drones.
And is this an effort for the FCC or America to have people buy American-made camera drones, or is there more to it than that?
On paper, that's certainly part of it. I don't think that this is a direct, you know, this isn't something that's approaching DJI directly. It's not like the FCC woke up and said, no, this company in particular is one that we don't like. It, you know, this will also impact a couple of other companies, including TP-Link. It is, you know, the goal here would be to give it the same kind of treatment that Huawei was given, you know, a company that makes phones and networking equipment and things like that, because they're, you know, they're not fully owned, and because they have no direct connection to a company here in the US, they are viewed as an extension of the Chinese government.
Does DJI, it's popular. Do they have a store? Is it all online orders?
It's almost entirely online, but you know, as someone who's been in the tech industry for quite some time, you don't go to tech events like the Consumer Electronics Show or things like that without seeing a really substantial presence from DJI in the last, you know, decade at least.
Okay. So people are reliant on DJI for making their drones. I mean, they create content with it. Are companies who use these drones going to push back saying they want to be able to buy these?
You know, there's been some outcry for this to you know, not go that way. And what the FCC has done, you know, with this vote, is there is now, you know, kind of an open period that will take place where commentary can be received. So I suspect that quite a bit of that from companies is what will happen over the next 30 days. But it is entirely possible that by the time we get into January or February of 2026, that DJI tech is just not available on Best Buy or Amazon or things like that.
Hmm. If you already have a product, a DJI drone, will it still work? Will the tech support still work?
It will currently still work. There's you know, the software is still, you know, released through Apple's App Store and you know, the Android Store, and there's currently no push to ban the software that goes along with this because it's very specifically tied to the hardware. And you know, so at a minimum, anything that you currently have on your phone or on your tablet to control a DJI device would remain, but there likely wouldn't be, you know, substantial software updates.
Hmm. Okay. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about some recent tech news with the Director of Commerce Content for CNET, Russell Hawley. Moving on to Apple, Apple might be making a deal with Google. They're hinting at a version of Google's AI Gemini, but for Siri, that will launch in the spring. So what is Apple considering right now?
You know, Apple has had a really interesting year when it comes to testing the waters for AI and not making any decisions. The idea behind what it called Apple Intelligence, you know, involved a lot of, you know, kind of local processing for being able to, you know, access your data. But if you wanted to communicate with OpenAI, you know, was the launch partner for Apple Intelligence, it's very much like a third party experience. You felt like you were using, you know, a different app. When communicating with OpenAI, and Apple maintained this sort of firewall, as it were, between these two tools, where you really had an understanding as a user that you were not asking Apple Intelligence a question, but instead asking Apple Intelligence a question on behalf of OpenAI. And so OpenAI as a response would, you know, give kind of a different thing. You know, for whatever reason, you know, the combination there is just seen as a lesser experience to what Google currently has on almost every Android phone now that Gemini is integrated into most things. So that, you know, and this is something that Google has been not shy about, you know, kind of blasting Apple for in ads. I haven't been to a movie theater in 4 months where there hasn't been at least one ad where Google is saying that Pixel phones have better AI than Apple. So what's likely here is that, you know, this is something that, you know, consumers are responding to, and they want Apple to have, you know, a better experience. And so Apple is kind of going back to a previous deal that the company has had with Google and is now going to consider paying them a fairly substantial annual sum for its iPhones to have access to Gemini.
Yeah. Okay. So Apple is going to pay a lot of money to Google to have better AI, for Google basically to make Apple's AI. Is that weird? They're supposed to be competitors, right?
This is not the first time that a deal like this has been done between Apple and Google. Apple, in very early days of the iPhone, would pay Google an annual fee for Google Search to be embedded in versions of its browsers. That this is these are two companies that have been certainly against one another competitively for some time, but still very much need to rely on one another for services and hardware. And so this is very much a continuation of that kind of relationship. But yeah, this is an acknowledgement on Apple's part that its current play for having AI embedded on its phone is not as effective as the one that Google has. And this is an attempt to address that.
Have they said how much money they're going to pay for it?
It is currently slated at $1 billion a year.
That's some money.
Yep.
But why hasn't Apple developed its own AI? I mean, Apple is like the biggest tech company there is. I mean, they're supposed to be the most fancy, one of the most lucrative tech companies out of there. Isn't it strange that they want to pay someone else to manage their AI?
Not really. I think Apple has always been a hardware company first and a software company second. Apple services have never come out, first and been the best. They are very, very good at paying attention to what the market is interested in and releasing the most polished version of whatever that thing is in order to be competitive. So I don't think that I would, see this as a massive deviation from the way that Apple typically behaves, especially when it comes to software. And Apple has been for want of a better description, Siri has been seen as kind of the worst of the smart assistants for going on 5 years now, and Apple really needs to change that reputation in order to allow it to integrate into the rest of its technology.
Is Apple just simply too far behind on AI right now? They'll never catch up if they don't get use someone else.
I think it is a terrible idea to ever assume that Apple is too far behind on anything. The first iPhone was viewed as being too far behind on smartphones. The first iPod was seen as being too far behind on MP3 players. Apple has a pretty powerful marketing machine and is able to, take something that tech enthusiasts are quite, fond of and making it something that is generally accessible and easier for folks. And so if they are able to do that with AI, then I think it will redound to their benefit. And if they're not able to, or if the AI bubble bursts as some companies are predicting, then Apple will have relative to their competitors spent very little for this experiment.
When will my Siri get better then, if we're going to do it this way?
If a deal like this is going to come out, I suspect that we will see some sort of announcement in the spring, to go alongside new Apple Watches or new iPads, some new features that would come along within Siri that they'll very casually suggest is through the help of Google and Gemini, but will really be a part of improvements to Apple Intelligence as a whole.
Are we going to go with the name Apple Intelligence, do you think? Or, yeah.
That seems to be where that's sticking with.
All right. This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Airbnb is testing out a new service that allows people to place an Instacart order before arriving at the property. How will this work, and why do we want this?
Yeah, so if you've ever used an Airbnb before, there's almost always some sort of smart lock on the door that has a PIN code, and it's a uniquely keyed to your stay in that Airbnb. So you're given a code before you arrive, and that code only works for the duration that you are there, renting that Airbnb. And then as soon as your rental period is over, that number goes away, and another person is given a different code in order to access the house. The way that Airbnb would partner with either Instacart or DoorDash or whichever company it wants to work with there, it looks like Instacart is kind of the big deal there. What would happen is before you arrive, you can say, you can place an order with Instacart and have these different things set up, and that person, the person making the delivery, would be given their own code that would only work that one time to access the house in order to deliver the groceries and then leave.
Interesting. I thought I read that it would be like the host unpacks and stocks items. So when you walk in, you have a fully stocked kitchen or something like that.
Yeah, so the delivery is something that's going to be on behalf of the Instacart folks, but the Instacart folks aren't going to be, putting things in cupboards and putting things in refrigerators. They'll be handling the delivery, and because of the way Airbnbs are set up, it is not necessary for the owner of the property to be there when that delivery happens, but the owner would very much, still need to be the one to put stuff away.
Okay, so this is just another way of making your stay in an Airbnb more comfortable, because then you don't have to worry about your own Instacart order. It's already there.
That's right. It's less time, you know, kind of messing with stuff and you know, waiting for things to arrive. And if the idea is that you're there for a weekend, you know, vacation, then, you know, more of your time is spent doing that.
Do we have a price point on this? Is it just what a normal Instacart would be, or is Airbnb taking a cut from it?
Yeah, so I mean, there's going to be some what Airbnb is calling rewards, you know, where hosts are able to, you know, have a percentage of a delivery that, you know, that could be a part of that. It's unclear how that's going to impact the actual cost of an order, and how that's going to interact with Airbnb. I suspect that this is something that they're currently testing out before it becomes a full feature, you know, mm-hmm. within their platform. But it wouldn't surprise me if there was some sort of extra, you know, tip or something for the person who's putting the groceries away.
Hmm. So do you think, Airbnb competitor Vrbo is going to team up with the Instacart competitor, and this is going to be a new thing, or is this a one-off? They're trying it.
It, you know, if this is something that is viewed as successful, it wouldn't surprise me to see, you know, more of this happening, not just with, you know, Airbnbs, but hotels in general. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, I've, you know, stayed at quite a few hotels over the last 2 years, and pretty frequently the first stop when you stop at a hotel is, okay, let's go ahead and order stuff before we go and do this other thing, so that there's stuff waiting for you in the room. And, you know, being able to, you know, not have to sit, you know, for an extra hour and wait for that delivery to show up is something that I'm sure will appeal to quite a few people.
We have been talking about recent tech news with the Director of Commerce Content for CNET, Russell Hawley. Russell, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show, you can find it at our website, wosu.org/allsides, or subscribe to our podcast. This is 89.7 NPR News.